Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. I like circumstantial evidence. I've said this before. It tells a story. Obviously, you want DNA evidence, fingerprints, and other scientific evidence to bolster the story. But when it's a domestic crime, the defense will be able to scoff at a lot of that evidence. They will say my client lived with the victim. Of course his fingerprints and DNA are in the house. In the Belinda Temple case, they needed the gun. If they had found the murder weapon, David Temple probably would have been arrested right away. It's probably the main reason this case went cold. The other issue we have to discuss is prosecutorial misconduct. Harris County DA Kelly Siegler was excoriated over her actions in this case. What is sad is that she herself likes circumstantial evidence. She was indisputably a very effective trial lawyer. She's folksy, sarcastic, and very engaging. She tells that story, and she didn't need to play dirty. But was it as bad as people think? And did David's attorney play fair? He was also a famous and respected lawyer, and he tried plenty of tricks himself. So David Temple got a second trial. Welcome to episode 128, The Belinda Temple Case, Part 2, The Trials of David Temple. Before we get started, I've got a correction to make. Heather Scott was not from Kansas, as I stated in the last episode. She was from Little Rock, Arkansas. However, she moved to Franklin, Texas when she was in the 8th grade. I know it's not a big deal, but I like to get things right. It also means to me that it doesn't sound like Heather just fell off the turnip truck from Kansas on the way to Houston, Texas. Franklin is about 2 hours away from Houston. She was essentially, at age 29, a Texan and had worked at Hastings High for a year. Then she moved into the new 9th grade annex building along with David Temple and his coach and friend, Quentin Harlan. Tammy Harlan would later say she found out from other teachers that Heather was a groupie for coaches. Tammy called her Barbie bitch, something she would proudly admit on the witness stand. Heather's flirtation started with Quentin, something he would later have to embarrassingly admit in court. But then David, ever competitive, started his own flirt campaign with Heather. The amount of emails between the two were voluminous. This wasn't just some casual hookup, as he would later try to portray it. And if he wanted to call it a hookup that he had ended, he probably shouldn't have married her. In May of 2001, 2 weeks before they married, David bought a nice house in Richmond, Texas, about a half hour from Katy. The house was beautiful, and it had palm trees around the swimming pool. Friends had been disturbed by David bragging about the money he had made when he sold the house on Round Valley Drive, the house where his wife was murdered. And now he quickly moved on, marrying Heather at a fancy country club and settling into the new house with her and Evan. Heather proudly began telling people that Evan called her mommy, all on his own. Heather's mother would later speculate to author Catherine Casey that Heather didn't have babies of her own because she and David had this dark cloud over them. She did become a mother to Evan, and maybe she didn't want to risk having more children on her own if David was ever convicted. Or maybe she didn't want to have a baby with a murderer. There are many people who believe that David's family knew he killed Belinda, though not all would go on record. Becky Temple, Kevin's wife, had been close to her sister-in-law, Belinda, and she made comments to both Brenda Lucas, Belinda's twin sister, and Tammy Harlan, Belinda's best friend. Becky not only suspected David, but seemed like she detested Heather. She and Kevin were so angry at David for his relationship with Heather that they stopped speaking to him for months, something Becky would later have to admit to at trial, though by then, she was towing the Temple family line. She wasn't the only one who didn't like Heather initially. Ken and Maureen Temple, David's parents, kept a shrine to Belinda in their home and were indeed frosty to Heather for a while before finally accepting her, probably because David insisted on it. At Hastings football games, Tammy Harlan, ever the football wife, there to support Quentin, shouted at, and heckled Heather when she tried to sit in the section for coaches' families. Heather, embarrassed, would get up and go to a different section. After a few games, Heather walked into the stands with the Temple family, a show of solidarity. She was now in the fold. But David and Heather were definitely living under a cloud. He knew he was still under investigation. He was so narcissistic that even though he knew he was being investigated, he still continued the relationship with Heather right after Belinda's murder. Heather's roommate, Tara Hall, later confirmed in court that David sent those Valentine's Day roses a month after his wife's brutal murder, and that David and Heather immediately began seeing each other again. At first, they just stayed at home at the condo, watching TV, rather than being seen around town. But by the next football season in 1999, they were ready to go public, whether Tammy Harlan liked it or not. Maybe David did love her that much. But if you were at risk for being tried for murder, wouldn't you stop the affair and do everything you could to look like the grieving husband? David didn't seem to care how it looked, and it did anger his family. And while he eventually let Tom and Carol Lucas see their grandson, it was under his supervision, at a McDonald's. There would be no weekends with Evan's other grandparents, or with his Aunt Brenda, who began tape recording conversations with David. And soon, even those pitifully short visits stopped. "None of y'all are supporting me. I don't know what you expect me to do," he whined to Brenda on tape. His strategy of keeping Evan from Belinda's family seemed to have worked. Maybe Evan would have always believed in his father's innocence anyway. The sad part is, Evan missed growing up with his mother's family in his life, and they missed him so much that it intensified their already immense grief. Investigators were frustrated, even haunted. Detective Mark Schmidt said, quote, "I thought about Belinda Temple's murder before I closed my eyes at night and first thing in the morning." But police and the DA's office knew they only had one shot at David. And there is no statute of limitations on murder, no matter how frustrated they were. They still hoped to find the murder weapon. And of course, they hoped David would slip up and say something incriminating to someone who had come forward. What Brenda Lucas had on those tapes made him look like a shitty husband, and of course, cruel and petty to Belinda's grieving family. The tapes may not have had a confession, but they would prove to be damaging in court. As I told you in the last episode, the DA's office did take the case to a grand jury. It wasn't so much to get an indictment as it was to get the testimony of certain witnesses on record before memories faded. They had investigators, friends, neighbors, Belinda's co-workers, and family members called to testify. Even an alternate suspect, who I briefly mentioned but haven't discussed yet, agreed to testify without a subpoena. David, of course, pled the fifth. When the grand jury was polled, they said the case was weak, but at least they had witnesses on record. Weeks turned into months, and within a year, Belinda's case was no longer a high priority. Her file sat on the desks of many investigators, but technically, it was a cold case now. And Belinda's family simmered. Obviously, they were hurting and angry that David hadn't been brought to justice. The months slipped into years. And then, another pregnant woman was murdered and made national news. When Lacey Peterson went missing in December of 2002 in Modesto, California, they watched the TV, seeing her radiant smile everywhere, and of course, thought of their beautiful Belinda. After Lacey and her unborn baby Connor were found in April, just a few months later, washed up on the shores of San Francisco Bay, her husband, Scott Peterson, was arrested just 5 days later. Modesto police had already been building a case against him without Lacey's body. As soon as they found her, they arrested him. The similarities in the case polarized the family and the DA's office. Even the media picked up on the similarities. The National Enquirer ran their photos on the front page, calling Belinda the new Lacey Peterson and Heather Scott the new Amber Fry. I'm sure you haven't forgotten, but just in case, Amber Fry was Scott Peterson's mistress. But Modesto authorities got lucky. Amber did the right thing and testified against Scott Peterson, while Heather Scott would insist that there was no real affair, despite the fact that they resumed their relationship almost immediately after Belinda's murder and got married 2 years later. The tabloid called David, quote, an outrageous liar whose deceitful tricks seemed ripped directly from Scott Peterson's game plan. Well, timing-wise, it would be the other way around, but this kind of sensational publicity helped. Belinda's father, Tom Lucas, wrote to Harris County District Attorney Chuck Rosenthal and threatened to go public with how he felt that his daughter's case had been mishandled and ignored. It was then that Rosenthal emailed Kelly Siegler, one of his star prosecutors. At that point in her career, Siegler was working as a special prosecutor. She liked cold cases. She reportedly kept a file of them on her desk labeled Waiting for God. But she also later said, quote, the Peterson case had changed perceptions. It made the public more aware that these types of murders do happen. Husbands and fathers do murder their pregnant wives and their unborn babies. She was right. By then, we had come a long way from charismatic assholes like Jeffrey McDonald. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. When Kelly Siegler took over the David Temple case, she had won 19 out of 20 death penalty cases. But David got lucky. It wasn't until September of 2003 that the Texas state legislature passed a law mandating that the killing of an unborn, viable infant was murder. Texas law requires murder with special circumstances for capital cases, like one committed during the commission of another felony. But Belinda was murdered in 1999. So her unborn, but viable baby girl didn't count. It was not a double murder, and therefore not a death penalty case. Kelly Siegler was an infamous bulldog of a prosecutor. She wasn't just well-known in Harris County or even Texas, but nationally. There was a People magazine article on her. They dubbed her a drama queen. A show about her life was being shopped around for television. However, David's family also hired a very famous and successful Lone Star lawyer named Dick DeGaren. He handled several high-profile clients, most notably David Koresh, before the Waco siege, obviously, and Robert Durst. If you've watched the documentary Jinx, you know all about Robert Durst. If you haven't watched it, I highly recommend it. Already suspected in two other murders, Durst was accused of killing his landlord, whose dismembered body parts were found in Galveston Bay in 2001. Dick DeGaren convinced a jury that Durst didn't kill his landlord, but just dismembered his body. Durst was amazingly acquitted on self-defense. Newspapers were calling the Temple trial the Clash of the Titans now. Siegler and DeGaren were both known for dramatic courtroom antics. And they had also sparred before. DeGaren had lost to Siegler twice. Whether or not he held a grudge, he had an excellent reputation as an attorney who was very prepared and chipped away at witnesses like Perry Mason, according to the Houston Chronicle. With these two on the case, legal wranglings delayed the trial until October of 2007. David had been out on a $30,000 bond since his arrest in November of 2004. Sparks flew at the first hearing. In February 2005, when DeGaren criticized Siegler for not getting an indictment from a grand jury, she told the judge she would, but then DeGaren asked for an evidentiary hearing. It was a huge mistake. The Harris County DA's office had a policy of keeping their case file open to defense attorneys. It was more than just a courtesy. Once some defense attorneys saw the evidence against their clients, they made a plea deal. Unless the defense attorney asked for an evidentiary hearing, then the DA's office strategically closed their file and only gave up what they had to by law. And they could do it painstakingly slow. By law, they only had to hand over reports after someone had testified, leaving the defense to scramble before their cross-examination. In court, when DeGaren asked for the evidentiary hearing, Kelly Siegler looked at him and said, quote, are you sure you want that, Dick? You know that will close the file. You need to put that in your back pocket. It is very important. A few weeks later, Siegler did get an indictment from a grand jury. She had the gunshot residue evidence from the FBI, an ace in the hole that they didn't have 5 years earlier. I mentioned that in the last episode. It's why they supposedly made the arrest. DeGuerin lost his evidentiary hearing now that there was an indictment. Under Texas law, he was no longer entitled to the hearing after a grand jury indicted David Temple. And remember, prosecutors do not have to put on their whole case for the grand jury, just enough to get an indictment. DeGuerin dunked back on Siegler in September of 2005 when he got the GSR evidence called into question. Initially, the first report showed gunshot residue on David's clothes and shoes. So while David's arrest was initially based on the FBI's lab finally getting their report back, it wound up being useless. What's more, the DA's office knew that the clothing sent to the FBI would need further testing. Remember what I told you to keep in your pocket in the last episode? A lieutenant with the sheriff's department had been careful to say that there was no new evidence. The arrest was based on, quote, increased work and totality of the evidence. I think increased work and totality of the evidence actually meant that they had scored infamous prosecutor Kelly Siegler. Because they knew further testing, specifically something called metallurgy testing, was needed for the GSR evidence to hold up in court. Then the Washington Post wrote a story discrediting metallurgy testing as junk science in September of 2005 in the middle of all the pretrial hearings. It was a pretty big scandal. Faxes were sent out to police departments all over the country. It would call many convictions into question. But the DA's office still had David's clothes retested, and months later, in the middle of the trial, the results showed GSR only on David's jacket and could not conclusively link it to the GSR on Belinda's clothes. Dick DeGuerin, who had been objecting to this evidence all along, went further. His team began looking into the testing process that the articles of clothing had undergone, including the lab facilities itself. During this investigation, the defense team found that the FBI lab shared the same ventilation system as the shooting range, meaning that all of the gunshot residue from the shooting range was going up into the vents and then coming back down into the lab. In a new hearing, the judge sided with the defense. Prosecutors had just lost their only piece of forensic evidence in the case. But they trudged ahead. Siegler felt confident in how the case was going. In total, she put 5 of the detectives on the stand. But 3 of the detectives who worked the crime scene defended their investigation under hard grilling by Dick DeGuerin. They also all testified to David Temple's lack of emotion at the scene, how he avoided eye contact, and how his story kept changing during questioning. When one of the detectives, Chuck Leithner, was on the stand, Kelly Siegler decided to face head-on the only ace she believed Dick DeGuerin was holding. She asked the detective if he had interviewed Joe Sanders. Riley Joe Sanders III was one of Belinda's students and her next-door neighbor. He was an admitted pothead who had missed so much school that Belinda went to speak with his parents about his truancy. He had skipped 131 classes already that year. She had also gone to Joe's parents and complained that when they were out of town, 16-year-old Joe had thrown a noisy party and she had to clean beer bottles out of her yard the next day. Siegler asked Detective Leithner, quote, "Did there come a time when you were satisfied or completely finished in your mind that you had what you needed from Joe Sanders?" And he answered yes. Dick DeGuerin jumped up and asked to approach the bench. He wanted it on the record that Joe Sanders had failed multiple polygraphs. "That's going to be denied," the judge replied. "We all know polygraphs are inadmissible in court, but DeGuerin tried anyway." So he took another tack with the detectives, asking about ammunition found in Sanders' home. Yes, it was double-aught shells, like the one used in the murder. But what all the detectives were able to testify to was that Joe Sanders and his friends had all been thoroughly investigated. His friends, because they were with Joe on the day of Belinda's murder. All of the teens and their parents allowed their homes to be searched, handed over all weapons, and cooperated fully with the police. And yes, there were 2 12-gauge shotguns that Sanders had access to, but they had been fully tested. But Dick DeGuerin called Joe Sanders a thug. He said the Temple family had always suspected him. But try as he might, he could not shake the officers on cross-examination. He would have to take his own shot at Joe Sanders later on direct examination when he put on his defense. Kelly Siegler was smart to get out ahead of the Joe Sanders question. It diffused whatever bombshell Dick DeGaren believed he would toss out during the defense. Things were going very smoothly. The other witnesses she put on were already damaging to David's character. Quentin Harlan had to testify to his own flirtation with Heather Scott. Heather didn't break up the Harlan marriage, but there really wasn't an affair to begin with. Quentin was bad for David on the stand. He called him manipulative and calculating, the type of man who planned out everything meticulously. He also said David jeered at him for not controlling his wife, the way David supposedly kept Belinda in line as he went out partying at bars and strip clubs. He told Dick DeGaren, "My wife is strong-willed. You'll see." He was right. Tammy Harlan, Belinda's best friend, in particular, was bad for the defense. She had firsthand knowledge of the problems in the Temple marriage, and specifically, how cruel and cold David was to his pregnant wife. He didn't even buy her a gift for her 30th birthday. Remember on December 30th, when he announced he was going hunting and actually spent New Year's Eve with Heather Scott? Brenda Lucas, Belinda's twin, also witnessed that and would testify to it. Brenda said he didn't buy her sister a Christmas gift either. Tammy also knew more about Belinda's daily habits. She said that when Belinda came home, she put her keys in a tray on the table and immediately kicked her shoes off. Remember, Belinda's keys were found on the stairs going up to the bedroom, and David claimed that's where she always dropped them. I already said I thought that was weird, but think about it again. She had a toddler in the house, and she's just tossing her keys on the stairs? And also, crime scene photos showed that Belinda was still wearing her shoes. Tammy also said Belinda would never have allowed David to take Evan without a car seat. This was a point I wasn't so sure about because of court transcripts, but evidently it was not something the defense could definitively dispute. When David was asked, he just said, "I have no idea." DeGaren did not try to explain the missing car seat in David's truck. Furthermore, Tammy testified that Belinda certainly would not have allowed David to take Evan to a park when he had been sick. The child had a fever. The suit Belinda picked up from David's mom was still sitting on the kitchen table in crime scene photos. Tammy helped paint a chilling picture. Belinda didn't have time to put the soup in the fridge, kick off her shoes, or put her purse and keys where they normally would be. Why is that? Probably because she was ambushed when she walked in the door. Heather Scott Temple was called as a witness for the prosecution, but she was hostile and argued over Siegler, painting herself as a victim of police harassment. She was even warned by the judge to stop getting into arguments with the prosecution. "You're not going to win," he told her. Still, Heather minimized the affair, saying she was only flirting with two married men, including Quentin. And she even said that sex with David wasn't memorable, causing laughter in the courtroom. She also denied her initial statement to police that 3 days before Belinda's murder, David told her he was falling in love with her, and she had replied, "I feel the same way." "I do not agree with those words in my statement," Heather insisted. Siegler asked her if the detective had made the statement up, and then Heather said those words were forced upon her. But the truth is, she volunteered that statement in an interview with Detective Tracy Shipley. Catherine Casey interviewed the detectives about this official statement in her book Shattered, which was really helpful in understanding Heather Scott Temple's later claims of coercion. This was a second interview with Heather after a polygraph she had taken had shown deceit. A male detective began the interview being intimidating. He said, "You lied to me, didn't you?" She said, "No, I just didn't tell you everything." He said, "That's the same as lying," and then left the interview in a huff. It was good cop, bad cop. Now Detective Tracy Shipley began the questioning, but in a softer tone. She still made it clear, though, that leaving anything out was the same as lying. Heather started opening up to the female investigator. She said David made her feel good about herself, but she still downplayed the relationship and the number of times the couple actually had sex. But she did say, quote, "To me, David was not dating me for the sex. He didn't push the relationship on me." I think she wanted to be clear that she wasn't some whore sleeping around with him, but that David was also not really asking her to be in a relationship. Those are contradictory statements. And she shot herself in the foot. Detective Shipley immediately followed up asking if David had ever told Heather he loved her. Heather said David told her, quote, "You know, I think I have totally fallen in love with you." Shipley asked, "What did you tell him?" And Heather answered, quote, "That I felt the same." Shipley told her they evaluated a suspect for motive, and being in love with someone else could be a motive to kill his wife. Detective Shipley later said, Heather gave a small smile and said, "You mean you think he killed his wife for me?" Shipley was disgusted, but nuance doesn't necessarily go into the official statement. But Heather's words did. And when she saw them typed up, she freaked out. Especially the part where she said David told her he was falling in love with her. "It didn't mean anything," she insisted. But Shipley told her if it was true that David said it, then it needed to be in the report. So Heather begrudgingly agreed to sign the statement. And Detective Shipley dutifully noted her objections and attitude, calling Heather Scott evasive and not forthcoming in her notes. Of course, Heather's polygraph was inadmissible, but her statement was not. And now she was suggesting that she was forced to say all that. Siegler rolled her eyes, but it didn't matter. Heather's demeanor on the stand spoke for itself, and her next witnesses would bolster the case even more. Throughout the trial, the prosecution maintained that David had access to hunting guns, obviously because no murder weapon was found, but it didn't mean David never had one. Shotgun shells matching the type used to murder Belinda were literally found in the same closet where her body was found. There were also two hunting rifles found in the same closet. One was a .22 and the other a .30-06, but no 12-gauge shotgun. What David, and later his brother and father, would testify to is that David only ever had a 20-gauge shotgun, which obviously was also not found. Their lie might have worked better if they could have produced a 20-gauge shotgun, but they couldn't. David's father, Ken, would insist, though, that he bought his sons Kevin and Darren 12-gauge shotguns, but David a 20-gauge, all at the same time in 1985 for Christmas. His reasoning? The 20-gauge was cheaper. That would have been David's junior year in high school. So you bought your golden boy, star football player, most favored son, the cheapest rifle? Ken Temple was also a hostile, aggravated witness, snapping at Kelly Siegler when she basically called bullshit on this story. A high school friend of Kevin Temple's disputed all of this, saying that all three Temple sons had 12-gauge shotguns, and he had hunted with them for years. Though he was a reluctant witness, Clint Stockdick was honest. He said the Temple family was like a second family to him growing up. He also said the Temples used reloaded shotgun shells, like the one used in the murder. He further testified that all of the Temples, Ken and his three sons, used 12-gauge shotguns. That's four total, plus one that was sawed off. But he had never seen a 20-gauge shotgun at the Temple house or used by Ken or any of his sons. Clint insisted that David Temple always used a 12-gauge shotgun when they hunted. DeGaren could not get him to budge on cross-examination. David's brother Darren also insisted his brother used a 20-gauge shotgun. He was really blasé about a lot of things on the stand, including whether or not he had lied about his brother's affair to the grand jury. He denied saying David had an affair, so Siegler handed him a copy of his testimony. He replied, "There's a definition of affair that I would like to discuss." Kelly Siegler, always quick-witted and effectively sarcastic, replied, "Are we doing a Bill Clinton? Are we going to argue about what affair means?" It was an extremely clever comeback, even almost 10 years after Bill Clinton's sex scandal. And it was not lost on the jury when Darren clarified he meant unfaithful. Okay, sure, that's not at all the same thing. Circling back, Ken Temple went so far as to suggest that Evan wasn't sick that day. When Siegler grilled him on this, he corrected himself by saying he was, quote, "not well." Boy, these Temple men love their semantics. An affair just means unfaithful. Sick enough to come home from school with a fever just means not well. Maureen Temple, David's mother, while not quite as hostile, didn't fare much better. When asked about the affair, she said, quote, Well, he spent a couple of nights with a female school teacher, not even naming her now daughter-in-law, the woman raising her grandson. When asked to clarify, Maureen Temple said it was, quote, a two-day weekend. I do not know about an affair. I know about a two-day weekend. When outright asked if her son was having an affair or not, Maureen lied and said no. Becky Temple, Kevin's wife, was also called by the prosecution. As I mentioned, she had made several comments to people about how she doubted David's innocence and how much she hated Heather Scott. But now, she was trying to be a loyal Temple family member. Siegler asked her, "Do you remember a time, Mrs. Temple, when you had a conversation with Tammy Harlan and you told Tammy that you thought David killed Belinda?" Dick DeGaren was furious and called for a sidebar. The jury was cleared from the room, and despite DeGaren saying Tammy Harlan was a liar and the testimony was inflammatory, Kelly Siegler informed the judge about the tape recordings Brenda Lucas had that would prove what Becky Temple had said. With the judge's help, Siegler and DeGaren came to a compromise. Becky Temple agreed to stipulate to 9 different statements she had made to Brenda. Among those were that she didn't speak to David for months after the murder, and that her husband Kevin had a falling out with his mother Maureen over Heather. Remember, Ken and Maureen were reluctant at first, but soon decided to accept Heather as part of the family. This had upset Kevin. Becky also told Brenda on tape that she didn't want to see Heather because, quote, I don't like to be lied to. A lot of the damage Becky could have done was mitigated by this compromise, but it still looked bad. None of David's family members helped his case. It would have been better for them to have admitted that, yes, he was having an affair, but he still loved his wife and he was a good father. He and Belinda were having problems, but that doesn't mean he would have killed her. I think that by having Heather, his family, and ultimately David insist that there was no real affair, DeGaren thought it would take away motive. David had a fling. He had no plans to leave or hurt his pregnant wife. That is not the impression his family left with the jury. They appeared defensive, hostile, and at times untruthful. That's the last thing you want from an accused murderer's family in court. And Dick DeGaren would have prepared them for Siegler's questioning. He was, again, a very well-respected trial lawyer, not just for his performance in trial, but in his exhaustive preparation. There's no way he let David's family get on the stand without preparing them. But DeGaren could not control their behavior on the stand, no matter how much he may have tried. Some witnesses just will not save themselves on the stand, no matter how much you try to prepare them. And it's not like he had a choice. They were called by the prosecution. As the trial progressed, there was also much testimony about the rice fields around the Temple family home. Ken Temple reluctantly admitted that his sons knew the acreage around their home very well. So lots of places for David to have disposed of the shotgun between the times that he was caught on surveillance cameras. And there is that witness who saw him at the intersection of Morton Ranch Road and Katie Hockley Cutoff between 4:50 and 5 p.m. His name was Buck Bendeman, and he knew David from high school. But maybe more importantly, he was really into trucks. He was able to describe David's truck, make and model, down to the shade of blue it was painted. Bendeman screwed up the timeline for the defense, but actually helps explain the gaps in the prosecution's timeline. The timeline of that day would be important. Belinda came home between 3:45 and 3:55. According to David's parents, she didn't leave until 3:45, so it had to be closer to 4. David himself had originally said it was 4. David also said she was tired, so he told her to go rest as he took their son to go to the park. The son, who was so sick, he was sent home from preschool with a fever, and Belinda had stopped to get homemade soup for him. And then David and Evan are spotted on a camera at 4:32 at the grocery store, walking back out at 4:38. They were not on camera again until 5:14, entering Home Depot. And then David was home by 5:30. Despite David's claims of traffic, that is 36 minutes of time he couldn't account for. Though he changed his stories about the parks he took Evan to, his final story was that he changed his mind about the park, decided to stop at Home Depot, and then go home. Go home to have dinner with his wife. Actually, to take his wife out to dinner. He said he always did on Bunko nights, the ladies' dice game Belinda was expected at later that evening. Except, as Tammy Harlan would testify, dinner was served at Bunko. I've played Bunko. There is usually dinner. Even if it's just hors d'oeuvres or potluck, it's part of the fun. So why would they have gone to dinner before she went to Bunko? Why would he claim they always did when that could be so easily disproven? Brenda Lucas was the last witness for the prosecution. She testified to the last time she saw her sister on their birthday, December 30th, 1998, just 12 days before her murder. Her twin sister was extremely unhappy. David openly belittled Linda, calling her a fat ass in front of her sister. That's right. He called his 8-month pregnant wife a fat ass on her birthday. Brenda was able to tell the jury that David told Belinda he was going camping for New Year's Eve, something at this point in trial was an indisputable lie. Some of Brenda's tape recordings were played, one of which David explained that his jewelry wasn't stolen by Belinda's killer because he had been wearing it that day. There was a photograph in evidence of all of David's jewelry. His wedding ring, championship football ring, gold watch, and gold chain were all sitting on a tray in their bedroom when the crime scene techs took photos. Brenda didn't just prove he was lying, but if you're a juror, are you asking yourself just why David wasn't wearing his jewelry? Maybe because there would be no chance of getting blood on it? And Brenda had an even more damning statement from David on tape. When Brenda asked if he wanted the crime solved, David replied, "What difference would it make? It won't bring Belinda back." Then he said, "Belinda wouldn't want all of this. She'd want us to leave it alone." Someone else had testified to a similar statement. When Quentin Harlan testified, he said that a few weeks after Belinda's death, he asked David if he wanted to know who killed Belinda. David said, "What difference is it going to make? It won't bring her back." You know, I gave David some benefit of the doubt in my last episode about the timeline. I do believe the heavy traffic in the area. I do think a man whose wife has just been murdered can be rattled and get his story confused. I do think that some people react differently to crime scene horror. So I even defended David's lack of emotion as possibly shock. But once you get to trial, all the little pieces start adding up to something totally different. Kelly Siegler said, quote, "This is a case of little bits and pieces. You put the pieces together and you have a picture." I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. Once the prosecution rested, Dick DeGaren began his case with the opening statement, quote, "David and Belinda Temple were deeply in love with each other. David and Belinda Temple were happy in their marriage. David was eagerly awaiting the birth of a little girl both David and Belinda named Erin." I guess this was his plan of action all along, but after the disastrous performance by David's family, not to mention his new wife, I would have backed off this tactic, at least a little bit. When DeGaren began his questioning, David said, "I loved Belinda very much, as well as she me, and loved my son and unborn daughter, as I will to the day I die." DeGaren asked him, "Can you expect the jury to believe a man can love his wife and be unfaithful?" David said, "I made a mistake. I wish I could go back and change, but I cannot. But I loved my wife very much, from day one to the day she died." Then he was asked to describe his relationship with Heather at the time of Belinda's murder, and he minimized, of course, saying it was, quote, "flirtatious emails, a casual romantic relationship." DeGaren asked him, "Were you in love with Heather then?" David answered firmly, "Not at all." When it came to the question of when David professed his love for Heather, he insisted that Heather and her roommate were wrong. Contradicting Heather's official statement, he said, "I did not use those words. I did not." He also claimed that Brenda lied about a lot of things, including that he didn't give Belinda a birthday present. He testified that he gave her a purse for Christmas and perfume for her birthday. Heather's roommate, Tara Hall, had testified to the nature of their relationship before Belinda's murder, including that Heather confided in her that he had said he was falling in love with her. And she also testified to the roses he sent for Valentine's, a month after his wife's murder, and how often David was at their condo and would disappear into Heather's room in the weeks following his wife's death. It's why DeGuerin's strategy of denial was so ill-advised. There were too many witnesses. Tara was at the New Year's Eve party. It was at the condo she shared with Heather. She knew David was there and that he had spent the night with Heather. Siegler went after David easily on cross-examination. So when Brenda asked him if he slept with another woman on New Year's Eve on that tape, was he lying? Yes, David admitted. Over and over, she asked him questions about things he had said while Brenda was secretly taping him, and he had to admit he had lied. There were so many things he lied about. Stupid things like dinner before bunco games, and how Belinda always dropped her keys on the stairs. He could have easily just said she dropped them by mistake that day, because she was tired. But he was trying to stick to his original statement as much as he could. And he was also trying to casually revise it in places, shifting times around, insisting that Evan woke up perky and full of energy. He said that Buck Bindeman, who saw David miles away from where he claimed to be that day, must have been mistaken. To his credit, he did not seem to get rattled the same way his wife and family had. He appeared soft-spoken and reasonable. But when you have to admit to lying that many times or simply saying, "I have no idea," it doesn't matter how calm your demeanor is. You're still a liar. When Siegler asked him about their 16-year-old neighbor, who was Belinda's student, David said, "I do not trust that Sanders kid." He said they'd had problems with him before. To be fair, Belinda did find those beer bottles in their yard after his party. But that's a far cry from cold-blooded murder. Kelly Siegler asked, "Are you telling this jury that you really believe Joe Sanders is the person who put a shotgun in the back of your wife's head and blew her face off?" "I have no idea," David shot back. "I wouldn't doubt it one bit if he did it." David also denied having a 12-gauge shotgun that Clint Stockdick had described. As for the sawed-off shotgun he had, he said he threw it away because it didn't work. "You didn't own a shotgun?" Siegler asked. "No," David insisted. "And what about the 12-gauge shells found in his closet?" He said, quote, "I don't know exactly where the shotgun shells came from. They were from previous use, is what I said." DeGuerin asked David about the alternate suspect, Joe Sanders. "What is your conclusion from these things?" He was talking about the shotguns the Sanders had willingly given to the police for testing. David said, "I would not like anybody to be falsely accused because I know how that feels. But that needs to be totally investigated." DeGuerin recalled Detective Dean Holtke, who again testified that yes, two 12-gauge rifles were found in the Sanders household along with the same size shells as the one used in the murder. But once Siegler was able to cross-examine her witness, he was able to testify that no glass or blood was found inside Sanders' shotguns and that the reloaded shells didn't match. Dick DeGuerin also trotted out the Roberts family kids, now teenagers, who said they heard a boom, like a gunshot, at 4:35 while watching a movie. Because David was on camera at 4:32, DeGuerin was still trying to prove the timeline wasn't possible, and that someone else shot Belinda at 4:35. But the Roberts kids were the only ear witnesses DeGuerin was able to produce. No other neighbors heard a shot. The defense rested, and the prosecutor called one final witness in rebuttal. Joe Sanders, now a 24-year-old, clean-cut young man, sat down on the witness stand. Siegler questioned him about what he did the day of the murder, about how he had cut classes and spent most of the day either smoking pot or looking for more pot. Yes, he had been grounded after Belinda spoke to his parents about his truancy. His parents took his truck away, but Joe said he wasn't angry. He just left school at lunchtime and took his truck back. He was polite and talked about how Belinda Temple was kind to him. He said he saw her daily at school and went to him, quote, whenever he needed help. He even said he saw her in the halls and she would joke with him, telling him to hurry up and get to class. She was a very nice lady, a good teacher, he said. He also described how he had been cooperative from day one, voluntarily testifying at the grand jury without a subpoena. He gave repeated statements to police. Siegler asked him why he agreed to talk to the detectives, Because I wanted to, he said. I didn't try to hide. When DeGaron got up to cross-examine Sanders, his first question was, have you been told you wouldn't be prosecuted for your testimony? Kelly Siegler jumped up and objected, and the attorneys got into a heated argument. DeGaron was insinuating that Joe Sanders had been given immunity from prosecution for Belinda's murder. In fact, he was given immunity for being charged with possession of marijuana back in 1999 for agreeing to talk to detectives. This wasn't a drug case, it was a murder case. As everyone waited, the judge read back over the original grand jury testimony and agreed with Siegler. The testimony explained they were talking about marijuana, the judge said. Dick DeGaron said, but it doesn't. The judge then angrily warned DeGaron, your question is absolutely trying to mislead the jury. DeGaron went back to questioning Sanders, basically shooting rapid-fire questions, hoping Sanders would slip up. Instead, Sanders remained calm, admitted to smoking pot, skipping classes, and insisting he was not angry with Belinda Temple. He even told the court about how the week before the murder, he was out shooting shotguns with his friends and then riding around, and his friends had knocked down some of the Temple Christmas decorations. He said he made the other boys put them back up. Dick DeGaron was never able to rattle Joe Sanders. He couldn't catch him in a lie, because Joe wasn't lying. While David Temple had also remained calm, he had been caught in numerous lies. Closing arguments began the morning of Wednesday, November 14, 2007. ADA Craig Goodhart began for the prosecution, pointing at David Temple. That man executed Belinda and his unborn child. A cold-blooded murder. There's no doubt about it. Did the sheriff's department make mistakes? They probably did. But that didn't mean that David wasn't guilty. Not one of the shotguns the defense pointed to, including those at the disposal of Joe Sanders, tested positive for glass, blood, or brain matter. And there was no evidence against Joe Sanders. What does your gut tell you? He asked. Goodhart finished with, David Temple is the only human who had motive, opportunity, and the desire to kill his wife. DeGaron came out swinging with his alternate suspect. There is more circumstantial evidence against Joe Sanders than against David Temple. Do I think the evidence against Sanders is enough for a conviction? No. But there is stronger evidence against him than against David. Kelly Siegler then stood up for her closing argument rebuttal. She said, quote, no matter how much you want to deceive, no one can do it perfectly. You know they lied to you and insulted your intelligence. The Temple family denied everything, acted like it never happened. Why? Because the family knows him. Because the family knows what happened. Facing the lack of a murder weapon, Siegler said, why don't we have the murder weapon? Because he got rid of it. She also pointed out that even though David had said he checked Belinda's pulse, specifically, he said he checked her carotid artery, there had been no blood on his clothes or hands. Then she said, quote, why was Belinda executed in the closet? Because David, the planner, realized it was the most protected room in the house, without windows and surrounded by clothes to muffle the sound of the gunshot. Then Kelly Siegler went after Dick DeGaron's alternate suspect. She said, quote, Joe Sanders? You know what you learned from Joe Sanders? He came here from Arkansas without a subpoena, and what did he tell you? I smoked weed. You know with all your heart that David Temple is guilty, she said. The jury deliberated for a couple of hours that last day of court, and then rested for the night. The next day, they came back with a verdict fairly quickly. In 8 hours, they found David Temple guilty. It took even less time for them to recommend he spend the rest of his life in prison. I'm going to pause now to hear a final word from today's sponsors. For years, David sat in prison for the murder of his wife. But 5 years into his sentence, his attorney got a break. A man named David Glasscock approached Dick DeGaron supposedly after he caught a TV special on David's case one night in May of 2012. After seeing the special, Glasscock felt uncomfortable with information he had been sitting on about Belinda's murder. He told DeGaran that back in 1999, he had overheard a disturbing story shared by one of his high school buddies, that not long after Belinda was killed, he was at a friend's house when he heard a story about a burglary that had gone wrong. One of the guys said that he had to shoot a dog and put it in the closet during the theft. Glasscock assumed a dog was code for Belinda, but he did not share the information with anyone else until he made the call to David's defense attorney. The friend that Glasscock was referring to was Riley Joe Sanders III, Dick DeGaran's alternate suspect. DeGaran believed Daniel Glasscock's story, which would later fall apart under more scrutiny, but the fire under Dick DeGaran had been lit again. With the help of a man named Stephen Clapart, an investigator at the DA's office, the evidence and information about the Belinda Temple murder investigation was re-examined, and it was learned that almost 1,400 pages from the Temple case file had been withheld. Only parts were given to the defense, and only during the trial after direct testimony. One of the main things the defense claimed to have found was that Joe Sanders was indeed a real suspect in Belinda's murder, a fact detectives disputed in David Temple's first trial. They all testified that he had been ruled out as a suspect. What they did find in the file was that a deeper investigation into Joe Sanders was not brought up at trial. Between January 11th and February 1st, Joe was interviewed 6 times by several different officers and provided police with conflicting statements. Joe said he was allowed to use his dad's guns whenever he wanted. Police found out that early in January, Joe had taken his dad's 12-gauge shotgun without permission and then gave the gun to his friend Cody Ellis to hide. The teen did hide the gun under his bed, but it was surrendered to the police the moment they asked to search the Ellis home. As I told you about in the first trial, all the shotguns the police seized were tested, including those that belonged to Sanders as well as the Temple family. None of the rifles tested positive for blood, brain matter, or glass. And as I told you in the last episode, the medical examiner had concluded that the gun had been put directly at the back of Belinda's head, and he testified that there would have been blowback on and in the barrel of the gun. And a firearms expert testified at the first trial and explained that shotgun barrels do not have rifling, a series of grooves cut into the barrel that leave striation marks on the bullets. So shotguns cannot be positively identified through ballistics the way other guns can. The best thing the prosecution could have found would have been David Temple's 12-gauge shotgun, if for anything, just to prove he had one. And it is much more difficult than some people might believe to clean a gun and leave absolutely no evidence. Lab tests more than likely would have shown blood on the guns tested. The other issue DeGaran and appellate attorney Steve Schneider used in David's appeal is that Joe also failed 3 polygraph tests, which included the question, "Did you kill Belinda Temple?" Now, polygraphs can't be used in court. We all know this, but twice during the first trial, DeGaran argued to get them in. But in the file records, on February 1st, back in 1999, police told Joe's parents that he couldn't be excluded as a suspect, and on February 10th, ADA Ted Wilson ordered police to continue investigating Joe Sanders. DeGaran would later say the defense learned that many investigators thought Joe Sanders was a viable suspect, but it was Kelly Siegler who had decided not to pursue the investigation against Joe, much less prosecute him. DeGaran said Sanders was cleared as a suspect because Siegler had already set her sights on David Temple. But Assistant District Attorney Donna Good had agreed with Siegler. She said, quote, "Teenagers don't usually make good criminals. They tend to be impulsive, leave evidence, get caught. The way the evidence laid out, Belinda Temple's murder was not like that. It was a calculated crime." Remember, Kelly Siegler was brought on as a special prosecutor by the Harris County DA after the Lacey Peterson case had put pressure on their then 5-year-old case. David Temple was their only suspect. As a team, Harris County detectives and prosecutors had cleared Joe Sanders. For years, DeGaran and appellate attorney Stanley Schneider accused Siegler of withholding evidence. Because the defense didn't have all of the files during the original trial, they claimed they only knew that Joe had skipped school and that Belinda had complained to his parents about his behavior. DeGaren and Schneider also said they didn't know the names of Joe's friends or the fact that two of Joe's friends had also flunked their polygraphs when asked if they knew who killed Belinda. But investigators at the time had thought these tests could not be conclusive. All the boys admitted to have tripped on LSD around the time they took the polygraphs and, of course, smoked a lot of pot. Those drugs can cause paranoia, which can look like deception during a polygraph examination. When Joe Sanders was asked to take a polygraph for the fourth time, it was his parents who refused permission. They said he had been through enough and was distraught over the brutal murder of his teacher. Furthermore, the polygraph examiner explained that he didn't interpret their tests to mean that they may have been involved in the murder, but that they knew something they weren't divulging. Investigators also pointed out that Joe and his friends had been in special classes at Katy High School. They had lower IQs. So one of their teachers helped the examiner form the questions. The examiner finally asked one of the boys who he thought killed Belinda Temple, and he said, "My mom told me David Temple did it." The original question had been, "Do you know who killed Belinda Temple?" And the boys had answered no. They were trying to be truthful about if they personally knew who killed Belinda. And there had been no physical evidence whatsoever to tie Joe Sanders, Cody Ellis, or his other friend, Corey Reed, to the Temple house. DeGaren and Schneider had theorized that the teenagers, looking for cash to score more weed, had broken into the Temple home, surprised Belinda, and then killed her because she was a witness. But the scene at the Temple house had looked methodical. The only things out of place were some opened drawers and that TV set carefully on its side. Belinda's jewelry box sat untouched on the dresser near the closet where she was murdered. David's jewelry lay on a tray on a table with a TV nearby. Belinda's purse had been found in the downstairs closet. Nothing had been stolen. Her cash and credit cards were still there. If the teenagers were on drugs looking for cash, they didn't look very hard. They didn't take anything that could have been pawned. And they didn't leave a mess you would expect, and they certainly didn't leave any fingerprints or DNA to prove they had been in that house. But according to Dick DeGaren, Joe Sanders took his 8-month pregnant teacher and neighbor to her closet and executed her. DeGaren and Schneider also alleged that Heather Scott had been coerced into making that statement about her and David declaring their love for one another in the days leading up to Belinda's murder. I already discussed this in detail because I did know it came up on appeal. Heather only balked once she saw her words in writing. She was not coerced. She was questioned by a seasoned detective who knew that Heather's ego would trip her up. She didn't like being thought of as a whore or a one-night stand. And she was in love with David. But David's attorneys filed an appeal stating that David's conviction needed to be overturned due to all the new evidence they were just uncovering. A 2.5-month-long writ hearing was held with Judge Larry Gist presiding. Under Texas law, during the time of the first trial, the defense was titled to the police reports, which made up many of the 1,400 pages that were uncovered in the investigation. But they were only entitled to the reports after the officer had finished testifying. But they believed now, many years later, that Kelly Siegler had purposely excluded evidence and particular officers from testifying so that she would not have to provide them with all of the evidence. Siegler also determined, as lead prosecutor, what was exculpatory and what evidence she deemed untrue and irrelevant. During the writ hearing, 30 witnesses and 200 exhibits were examined. The defense argued that Brady violations had been committed through prosecutorial misconduct, causing David to have an unfair trial. Brady violations, for those that are unfamiliar, have to do with the state or prosecutor in a case not handing over evidence that could benefit a defendant's case. Under the 5th and 14th Amendments, a prosecutor has a duty to disclose favorable evidence to defendants upon request, if the evidence is material to either guilt or punishment. Failure to comply with this duty has become commonly known as a Brady violation. It was named for a precedent-setting case from 1963 called Brady v. Maryland. Kelly Siegler testified at the writ hearing that she didn't give the defense all the material regarding Riley Jo Sanders because she thought it was irrelevant and ridiculous. Siegler later stated, "I would give them all the discovery they were entitled to, piece by piece, day by day, very slowly and very miserably, they got what they were entitled to have." She said she was going by the hard rules. The defense filed a motion for continuance but were denied. And I think this is what sunk Kelly Siegler. Her ego was too big. She first ignored subpoenas to appear at the hearing, and when she did come, she was haughty and sarcastic. She was obviously irritated that her judgment had been called into question. It's not that she was wrong. It was her manner. She did not come off as professional, but as disrespectful. And I do think it's important to note that Kelly Siegler was following the letter of the law during the David Temple case in 2007. The Michael Morton Act wasn't signed into law until 2013. I covered Morton's case of wrongful conviction in episode 110. The act, signed into law, requires prosecutors to open their files to defendants and keep records of the evidence they disclose. The Daily Sentinel reported that Judge Gist sided with defense lawyers who claimed Kelly Siegler violated this, quote, central tenet of modern criminal law by not handing over the information she knew about that could have been helpful in David Temple's defense. Well, that central tenet was not in effect in 2007. Reporters were basing their opinions of Kelly Siegler in the year 2016. At the end of the hearing, Gist found that Kelly Siegler had committed 36 distinct acts of prosecutorial misconduct in the case of David Temple. Judge Gist recommended that David Temple receive a new trial due to the Brady violations. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals would look over Judge Gist's recommendation and make the final decision. Judge Gist said, quote, "Trial counsel's performance was not perfect, but much of the difficulty he faced was driven by constant resistance of the trial prosecutor to reveal necessary information. Trial counsel continued to seek helpful information from the prosecutor, but little was disclosed prior to trial. It was literally impossible for trial counsel to sufficiently investigate, verify, or dispute the disclosures." Following this, Kelly Siegler said, "Just because one judge made these ridiculous findings that none of us can understand, he's not the final say. The Court of Criminal Appeals is, thank God." And she was right. On November 23, 2016, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals granted David a new trial. A little less than a month later, in December 2016, he was released from prison to await his retrial. Kelly Siegler was absolutely demonized in the press. Understandably so. According to Judge Gist, either her conduct had gotten a murderer out of jail, or an innocent man had sat behind bars for almost 10 years. The Houston Chronicle was particularly scathing in their reporting on Kelly Siegler, but they weren't the only ones. Many reporters believed that Siegler used the Temple case to bolster her TV career. And for the record, Siegler and her show, Cold Justice, have been sued twice now for defamation. She was also sanctioned for withholding evidence in another case, and it was a capital murder trial. While it's alarming to see the claims of defamation, prosecutorial misconduct, and other shady behaviors of Kelly Siegler, it's not surprising that this kind of behavior was born out of the Harris County District Attorney's Office, which has an upsetting track record itself. Harris County, Texas, has executed more people than any other county in the United States since 1976. The Houston Law Review study of the death penalty cases found in 96% of cases, judges accepted the prosecutor's findings without additional investigations or evidentiary hearings. Kelly Siegler had won 19 out of 20 capital cases. And since the year 1975, three people condemned to die in Harris County were later exonerated. I admit, because of the writ hearing and the supposed 36 distinct acts of prosecutorial misconduct, I began to have my doubts, especially once I read all the articles about Kelly Siegler's practices. Because of the defamation lawsuits, Cold Justice was put on hold. It's still undecided if the show will come back. Then I came across an article in the Houston Press by Craig Melso. He said, quote, In the rush to persecute Siegler and make a martyr of Temple, the media neglected to compare Gist's findings to the trial record. If they had, they would have seen that the findings don't stand up to scrutiny. They're a flawed and often contradictory assessment of what actually occurred at trial. A closer look doesn't suggest proof of a reckless prosecutor caught in her tracks, but of shrewd defense attorneys able to kick up enough dust to cloud a judge's vision. So I got curious, and I decided to look a lot harder at David's first trial than I had planned. It had all seemed fairly straightforward to me in the beginning. Now I wanted to see these contradictions for myself. This is why I decided to split the episode into two parts. In that Houston Press article, most notably, Craig Malso pointed out, quote, DeGaron had taken over the case in November 2004. By the time he sought an examining trial in February 2005, he had had 2 months of unfettered access to the case. Gist's findings don't acknowledge that DeGaron simply took a legal gamble and lost. Do you remember that part earlier in this episode that I said to keep in your back pocket? I told you it was really important. When Dick DeGaron asked for the evidentiary hearing in February of 2005, Kelly warned him. She said to him, quote, "Are you sure you want that, Dick? You know that will close the file." David Temple was arrested on November 30, 2004. The pretrial hearing where Dick DeGaron asked for an evidentiary hearing was on February 1, 2005, meaning he did have all of December and January to look at all of the evidence the DA's office had on his client and on his alternate suspect, Joe Sanders. And Kelly Siegler warned him that, in case he had forgotten, he still had access to all the evidence she had unless he insisted on the evidentiary hearing. As I told you, Harris County had a policy of keeping their evidence open for defense attorneys. It wasn't just to give them a fair shot. It was more because once they got a look at the evidence against their clients, most attorneys wanted to plea bargain. So Dick DeGaron was full of shit. He was either too lazy to look at the file, which from his reputation is hard to believe, or he specifically asked for that evidentiary hearing to close the file. Kelly Siegler later said, quote, "Dick was a prosecutor before a defense attorney. He should have known. Asking for the exam trial was a dumb move. How do you prepare for a circumstantial evidence case without seeing the evidence?" Unless, of course, that was his strategy. He saw the evidence, knew Joe Sanders had been rightly dismissed as a suspect, but using him as an alternate suspect might sway the jury. That would only work if David had come off as sympathetic and truthful, which he didn't. Or maybe DeGaron figured he might could leave an opening for his client on appeal. And that did work. David's second trial began on July 9, 2019, 20 years after his wife's murder. And during this time, Heather filed for divorce from David. Obviously, no public reason was given, and she did not change her testimony from the first trial. She still tried to protect David. Following the finding of prosecutorial misconduct in the first trial, the Office of the Texas Attorney General acted as a special prosecutor in the retrial. Their case was still that David killed Belinda, but this time, they theorized that David split up the tasks of killing her and staging the burglary. According to the prosecution, David could have killed Belinda between the time she got home and when he left to run errands, then staged the burglary when he got home before he ran to his neighbors for help. Prosecutors said that there was time between leaving the grocery store and arriving at Home Depot when David could have gone somewhere to throw the shotgun away. The defense's theory was that Joe Sanders killed Belinda and that the timeline proved David couldn't have killed her. According to David's father, Belinda was at his house until 3:55 p.m. That meant Belinda probably didn't get home until 4:12 p.m. David was seen on a surveillance camera entering the grocery store at 4:32 p.m. Based on those times, David wouldn't have had time to kill Belinda between 4:12 p.m. and 4:19 p.m. when he left to run errands. The defense also re-emphasized that there was no physical evidence tying David to the murder. During the trial, Joe Sanders testified that he had nothing to do with Belinda's murder. He was now 37 years old and married with children. He told jurors that the murder of his former schoolteacher had stayed with him his whole life, along with the suspicion against him. He was Riley Joe Sanders III, but he didn't want to keep the tradition and give his son his name because it was still so tied to Belinda's murder. Joe Sanders' ex-girlfriend from high school also testified for the prosecution, telling the jurors that her then-boyfriend wasn't very good at keeping secrets, and that he told her after Belinda's murder that she was one of the only teachers who truly cared for him and wanted him to succeed. And the whistleblower, David Glasscock, who started this whole thing, didn't testify at trial. They couldn't use him. He kept contradicting himself on what he knew and when, and it came out that he didn't even know the murder weapon was a shotgun until Dick DeGaren told him during his first interview. Glasscock, with his own record of an assault conviction from 2008, showed a substantial criminal history and a predilection for drugs. That assault conviction was from when Glasscock pulled a man from his car and beat him so severely he required 7 metal plates to be surgically inserted into his face and head. It wasn't some silly bar fight. He almost killed a man in a road rage incident. Daniel Glasscock had no independent knowledge of the murder except what Dick DeGaren fed him during their interviews. Also, as it turns out, Glasscock's original epiphany, which he said came from watching a documentary about the murder on the Investigation Discovery Network, couldn't even have happened when he said it did. The show didn't air at all in the month of May or any surrounding months. So essentially, David Temple was put on trial with the same evidence. There was just more detail about Joe Sanders and his friends during the initial investigation, and it didn't help Temple's case one bit. On August 6, 2019, David was once again found guilty of murder. The jury was tasked with coming up with a sentence for David, with the possibility ranging from probation to life. They deliberated for 20 hours, but were unable to make a decision. 2 people wanted probation, 6 wanted between 30 and 40 years, and 4 wanted life. Because of this indecision, the judge had to declare a mistrial for the sentencing phase of the proceedings. David's bond was set at $1 million, and a sentencing hearing was set for March of 2020, but due to COVID-19, David's sentencing was again delayed. His family was not able to pay that high of a bond, so David has remained in jail while awaiting his sentencing trial. Because of the deadlocked jury during the sentencing phase of his second trial, David Temple and his counsel requested a third trial, rather than a new jury that would only review the conviction and possibilities for sentencing instead of getting to see an entire trial played out before them. State law from 1999, the year of Belinda's murder, required the same jury to determine guilt in sentencing. That law changed in 2005, before David's first trial. Now a different jury could be seated just to determine sentencing. David's attorney's request for a new trial was made in January of 2020, but was denied. Since then, there has been no movement on the case because of the pandemic. Evan Temple's testimony during the sentencing portion in his father's second trial was seemingly enough to impact the jury. Now in his mid-20s, Evan still believes his father. He also considers Heather Scott, David's now ex-wife, to be his mom, as she raised him the majority of his life and has treated him as her own. He's a college graduate working as an accountant and is happily married. I am glad Evan seems to be living such a happy life, and I am looking forward to a very unprecedented trial just for sentencing. A mistrial only on the sentencing portion is highly unusual, and though I believe David Temple is guilty, I'm not sure I agree that this new jury should only hear evidence of his guilt. I think it should be a whole new trial. What's the harm? Glasscock as a witness has been neutered, so to speak. Joe Sanders was never a viable suspect, so let's put it all on again. It's not like this case hasn't received enough publicity that new jurors won't know a lot of this anyway. What worries me is that the publicity of Kelly Siegler's misconduct has overshadowed the fact that she did do her job. Even if she had turned over every bit of evidence to Dick DeGaren before trial, I do not believe that reasonable jurors would believe that a pothead 16-year-old would execute his pregnant teacher. And that even if he would, he would leave no evidence at the scene. David Temple was a meticulous man. I don't think you even need to split up that timeline. He had been home with Evan since around 1 p.m. that day. He easily could have staged the break-in before Belinda ever walked through that door. No, I believe David Temple met his wife at the door with his shotgun. Evan had a fever. He probably gave him some Motrin and put him to bed. Belinda would not have screamed. She would not have wanted Evan to see this. I think he grabbed her purse and the soup and then marched her up the stairs to their bedroom. She dropped the keys on the way. He probably did choose the closet as the most soundproof room in the house. Maybe he told her to get on her knees. Maybe Belinda crouched down, protecting her belly and unborn child, as her husband, the man she loved despite everything, put a shotgun to the back of her head as she begged for mercy and blew her beautiful face off. Southern Fried True Crime is produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched and written by me. I also edited this long episode, so apologies if it isn't perfect, and I'm sorry for the wait. I found so much more detail I wanted to include, and I hope you found it as fascinating as I did. I think we'll all be following this case, and I'll make sure and update you on social media when David does finally get his sentencing trial. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. I've been reminding y'all, but don't forget to come find our new Facebook group. Search for Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group. And please submit case suggestions to southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept suggestions on social media, and I apologize if I am unable to answer your email. I get dozens of suggestions a week, and it takes me time to go through and check out each case. I will definitely contact you if I plan to use the case you submit to see if you would like to be credited in the episode. Thank you all so much for sending in these cases. I truly get my most interesting cases from listener suggestions, so keep them coming. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care. Yeah.